There are a lot of good questions here. This is Jim Winkler. I'm the technical representative for the two hubs based here in Washington. One of the questions is, how does USAID work with DFID and World Bank and coordinate with them? The East Africa Trade and Investment Hub has a memorandum of understanding with Trademark, which is a multi-donor. I think nine donors fund it, including DFID and the World Bank and USAID and others, and they work on the trade facilitation corridors across the region. So they have really enabled the movement of grains and other product across borders, across East Africa community. That has been critical. The World Bank also has a program in Southern Africa that the Southern Africa Trade and Investment Hub coordinates with. There's also a DFID Food Trade East and Southern Africa program that is working on both seed trade and harmonization across East and Southern Africa, as well as policy and...
Sorry, we lost you for a moment. We're back.
Okay. I'm just answering a quick question here. Johannes, on one of the online questions about how USAID coordinates with the World Bank and DFID, and I'm just closing that out. Someone else asked a question about seeds and how important...
Well, actually, before we go to USAID, I'd also like to comment on that. As Jim was talking about, this is Scott Cameron, by the way, from Kenya East Africa Mission. As Jim was correctly mentioning, we do a lot of work with Trademark East Africa, which does have nine donors. We are heavily active on the board. We meet quarterly on the board, but we engage regularly throughout the year. That program in and of itself is about a $600 million program focusing primarily on trade facilitation and the work we do at the ports and along the main trade and transit corridors and that go through Kenya and Tanzania. We have spent hundreds of million dollars on infrastructure improvements and systems improvements at ports, on road feeder roads, as well as one-stop border crossings, which have customs officials from both countries along the border in order to reduce the cost of doing business. And I think one great thing about that is, as we've seen, is about 40% of all costs associated with trade, and this is inclusive of food, is coming from these transit and logistics costs. And so by addressing some of the infrastructure constraints, and even at the port alone, if you address some of those constraints that we've been dealing with as a donor community, you can cut the cost by 50% of trade and transit costs. So there are significant savings that we can do, and I think this is a perfect example of how across many donor agencies, across many countries, we have been collaborating very well. So anyway, thank you.
Yeah, just to add a quick answer to the question, we consulted and worked with, for example, with Food Trade Eastern and Southern Africa, which is funded by DFID. We consulted and discussed the various issues involved in this regional cross-border grain trade with WFP. Our partners, EAGC, for example, are part of what's called the MAS Group, the Market Analysis Working Group, that works with the FAO, WFP, USAID, FuseNet, and a few more other agencies. And so this is really a collaborative process. So we've consulted widely. We've researched the issues. We've met with governments and with other partners, various partners involved in this process. And we eventually arrived at a proposal, at a strategy, and worked with our mission, with Scott and his team, to be able to implement the strategy. There's a great deal amount of front-end work that and collaboration and consultation has taken place before we actually did the first B2B. So with that, I'd like to wrap up today's presentation, and we'll move forward to the Q&A portion. First, I'd like to call upon Kristen. Sorry, I rushed to the Q&A. There's some really great questions, and we're eager to answer them. Kristen, over to you.
Sure, thank you. So, Jenna Lacey has asked us, what are the hubs and USAID doing to ensure that this transaction-based approach is sustainable? How are you working to ensure that these aren't just one-off successes?
All right. So I will quickly provide a quick answer, and I'll invite my colleague Gerald to also talk about this. As I said earlier, when we did the Ethiopia B2B, not even days after we concluded, there were traders already going to Addis and transacting. So we just opened the gates for them. We educated traders on the various technical barriers, standards, payment terms, logistical challenges, even cultural issues about trading. For example, payment, Ethiopian traders will only use LCs and will only use the CAD or cash against document process. They will not use any other method. This is foreign to some of the EAC traders. But once we were able to break the barriers and make the connections, these traders didn't need us. They continued to trade and connect with Ethiopian traders. Same thing with Zambian traders. Some of the Zambian traders, for example, have set shop in Rwanda, in Kenya, to be able to further facilitate their own trade. But the most important part of the sustainability model for us is really we don't do this work. This is really an activity of the EAGC to benefit their members and the regions. We provide technical support using the small amount of money we have and the internal know-how we have, working closely with the EAGC to provide these solutions. And through this process, for example, we're working closely with the EAGC to help them open an office in Ethiopia. They've never had an office. They've had members, but not an office. Right now, we're going through that process. We also collaborate with them in their opening office process in Zambia. Over to you, Gerald.
Yes, thank you, Johannes. One of the things I would like to say is that these B2Bs and the trade facilitation processes are now embedded as part and parcel of EAGC services to the members. So they will not end now. In fact, they've been institutionalized, and we are even going, we're already using technology, using our GSOCO platform to take these B2Bs to another level. So in summary, this will be continuing because it's embedded as part and parcel of EAGC day-to-day services to the members.
Kristen?
Great, thank you. We've got a couple questions here that are related. Jill Luxenberg asked, how is food safety being addressed under the program? Are aflatoxin levels being measured? And partnering with that, Margaret McDaniel asked, along with aflatoxin monitoring, are pesticide residues being monitored? This is particularly important as farmers become more desperate about fall armyworm.
All right, I'll invite Gerald to respond to that question.
Yeah, thank you. As we said earlier on, the question of standards and grades has been central in these B2Bs, and it is one of the prerequisites to the trade that the quality parameters are done. So how is this done? Is that for all the transactions in the B2Bs, you have to get your test analysis, your lab test, your analysis, your grading certificate that confirms that the consignment being transshipped or shipped across has met all the quality parameters, which include aflatoxin levels. So the response I would like to give is that is a feature, something that is a prerequisite and is happening in each and every of these cross-border B2Bs that we're doing. That covers and ensures that there is absolute food safety and the quality parameters and quality standards are met. Thank you.
And I want to add a very important caveat. It's really important to understand this is formal trade, right? Previously, trade existed between these two regions, mm-hmm. Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, and Ethiopia, the Horn of Africa and Eastern Africa. But it was largely underground. It was smuggling. Illegal trade. So the illegal or informal trade did not comply with standards. Aflatoxin, pesticide residues, it did not involve any of that. We facilitated formal, transparent, large-scale transactions, right? So no quality standards or requirements were compromised. The work we did was to simplify the bureaucratic documentary requirement process, making sure border agencies talk to each other and reduce or eradicate redundancies, right? So the crisis gave us an opportunity at the highest level. I mean, it's just to give you an example, with the Kenyan government, the president of Kenya at one point was considering ordering the army to go to the border and pick up maize from Ethiopia because Ethiopian trucks could not cross the border. But that level of attention gave us an opportunity to identify these barriers and work hand in glove with government to address this emergency, not by compromising quality standards, but making sure the standards are met with less and less costly bureaucratic processes.
Great. So we've got a couple questions related to a bit more the nuance of the B2B events. Lindsay Bigaman asked, how did you identify the grain traders who participated in the B2B events, and what did they need your support for? And then Celia Gare asked, what has been the role of host governments during your B2B sessions, if any?
Great job.
Thank you. I will take those two questions. The first one on how we identify the grain traders. The traders that we were able to get for both sides, the supply side and the demand side, are members of EAGC, and those that were and other prominent grain traders that were able to bring on board. So, and this is where the partnership process becomes now important, because if they have maybe tried to do this without working with EAGC, they would have had difficulties identifying. But working with EAGC, we have membership, we have the members, we're able to get them. But in addition to that, and particularly in Ethiopia, I think also in Zambia, but in Ethiopia, we placed an advert where we also opened up an invitation, and that also helped, because in Ethiopia, like Johannes said earlier on, we have a membership, but we don't yet have offices. So we use that process to get to where the public to know. And in the process, we actually ended up recruiting quite a number of members into EAGC from Ethiopia. So that's how we did it, how we identified the grain trader. With regards to the role of the government, I mentioned earlier that in all these B2Bs, we had government representation present. In fact, the B2Bs were officially, the official opening was done by the government officials in Ethiopia, in Zambia, even in Rwanda, and therefore they provided their support to back up the processes. But in addition to that, we had, like Ethiopia East Africa Connections, and the issue of the duty waiver. We could not have gotten this without the government helping us, both the host government and also the receiving government. And also, like I mentioned earlier on, the whole process of the documentation, the certifications, the licenses, the permits, the clearances across the borders, because this was all pure formal trade, where every single piece of compliance must be met. This again was made possible with the support of the government. Thank you.
Just to add from our perspective, from the House perspective, what we've done also, in addition to what EATT has done, we hired a consultant, an Ethiopia-based consultant, to support Ethiopian traders, again, to go through the compliance process. They never traded with the EAC member country traders. And meeting these requirements were very complicated. Not just the EAC requirements, but also the Ethiopian export ban posed a huge challenge. The documentary bureaucratic requirements were very difficult. So our consultants worked hand in glove with the traders, worked with the Addis Ababa Chamber of Commerce, which was our local partner and a partner to EAGC as well, on this process to make sure that all of the requirements were met and members and traders understood what needs to be done. But even more important for us as a project, we need to make sure we had documentation and we tracked the trade. So we were able to collect contracts, payments, even pictures of trucks crossing the border. We knew at some point no one was going to believe us, 100,000 metric tons was was crossing over to Kenya from Ethiopia. And it just would be laughable if you say that to anyone in a year where Ethiopia had 8 billion people needing emergency food assistance. But again, if you don't understand the background, the context, yeah, people would be surprised. So we have to work very hard to make sure we document the process with the help of our consultant.
Great, thank you. I have a question here for Scott specifically. How has food aid policy changed due to some of this learning? And is this a solution for future crises?
So in terms of food aid policy, I mean, I think that is something that is evolving over time. Initially, when we were talking to our food aid colleagues related to some of the B2B work we've had in the movement of staple food around the region, it was actually approached with some suspicion, given that, you know, taking food from one country to another, but like, well, we're trying to educate people not only through conversations like the one we're having now, but also our colleagues in the humanitarian assistance side, is that, you know, with the understanding is that the region can feed itself. It's these barriers that are preventing food from moving across borders, again, from areas of surplus to deficit. So by breaking these down, and over time, if we look at the system, as the whole region as a system, and one common market versus independent specific countries, and with in silos, then I think that's the problem we get to. Oftentimes, as the U.S. government, USAID, in general, we're very siloed, and we look at things country by country, and it's not often we take a step back and take that regional approach. So, saying that, things like this and educating people about the broader benefits and possibilities around this type of approach in terms of private sector led, in terms of the potential for sustainability over the long term, I think this is kind of the first step. And I think over time we will get even more success with this model. And I think more and more people will recognize that, both inside and outside of the U.S. government.
Great, thank you. I've got a couple questions related to kind of data and tracking. So Mark Lundy asked, in addition to tracking trade volume, have you also been able to track changes in grain sales prices for consumers? And if so, how have those varied? And Dorothy Tuma from Uganda asked, how are you able to obtain true or accurate figures on the value of transactions between B2Bs? Could there be some underreporting, and thus the value of the trade generated might actually be higher?
All right, I'll tackle both. In terms of pricing, I think it's been very public in the EAC, especially here in Kenya. In fact, the government introduced a subsidy program to limit the growth of food prices for 2 kilo maize flour, which is really a major staple for the average folk here in Kenya. It's an essential food security issue. So eventually through the government directly, by the way, bought 50,000 metric tons with our help for the food subsidy program, which was then sold to millers at subsidized price. And eventually the price of 2 kilo maize flour dropped from almost $2 to about $1.30, a huge amount of drop. Now, we did not participate in the subsidy program. It had the distortive effect in the marketplace. It was well-intentioned, but may not have ended up helping the market. But it did end up consumers. It reduced the average cost of maize flour in Kenya. And in general, in the region, I can give you, there's been studies. For example, Rwanda had the smallest amount of price rise to about $400 per metric ton. That's partly unique to Rwanda because the Rwanda grain reserves were well managed and were properly managed. And the maize purchases they were able to take in, for example, from Zambia, a lot of the maize that Rwanda bought came from the Zambian B2B process, allowed Rwanda to stabilize local maize wholesale prices. So in general, it had a significant and visible impact on retail market prices. Again, prices is really an outcome of supply and demand. You increase supply, price is going to fall. Now, by all means, it's not just our work. Private traders, millers, and even some governments have directly imported also from outside of the region. Kenya, for example, has, I think, imported close to 300,000 metric tons from Mexico and elsewhere, in addition to what Kenya has bought from Ethiopia and Zambia.
I'll come in on the question of tracking the data and whether it's accurate. And just emphasize that what we have done and we are doing with the B2B is formal trade. And with formal trade, you have every piece of documentation with you, and therefore you are able to get the data very precisely of the quantities that are being bought and are being shipped across the border. So for formal trade, there is no issue in getting the data. Thank you.
Now, just to add to that, the challenge for us is that conditions change. Even after the B2B prices, sometimes times elapse between what happened at the B2B and at delivery point. Prices may change. Cost of logistics may change. New policies may come up and slow down the delivery process. So sometimes there are price changes, but we do try, we do our best to follow up and capture the final delivery price and quantity. We're not always successful, but we do our best.
Great, thank you. Related to something that you just actually talked about in terms of the private trade that's going on beyond you guys, Loretta Burns mentioned, I was in Zambia a few years ago when they were overflowing with maize that the government had procured from farmers and traders, but at great cost to the government. I believe they sold at a loss. Are there traders and companies in place that can acquire sufficient amounts for international trade without government subsidies? So back to that sustainability question.
Yeah, I'll take that question and specifically say that this being the case in Zambia, when we did the B2B, of course we had buyers from the whole region. We had buyers from Rwanda, Burundi, Tanzania, Malawi, Kenya, Uganda. We had the whole region, and those that managed to sign the B2B contracts and do the delivery were all private traders who were able to buy the grain themselves and bulk it and do the whole trading, and they were able to access the grain. However, in that process also, we are also aware that around that time, the government then was quite aware that the next harvest was coming, and they still had substantial stocks in their strategic reserves, and they also did offer for sale quite a number of their stocks, quite a bit, a good percentage of their stocks out into the trade. But I would like to respond to the to Loretta and say that yes, indeed, some particular private traders, private companies, were able to acquire sufficient quantities and do trade and move quite good volumes across the region. Thank you.
But also, just to add, it's an important element of strategic grain reserve management. You have to replenish or change what's reserved. Otherwise, quality deteriorates if you keep it over a long period of time. So it's a good practice for governments who manage strategic grain reserves from time to time, even if there's no market crisis, for the reserves to sell and buy new harvests or new crops. So it's part of a good practice, a good management practice, and not always designed to subsidize traders or consumers in that sense. So there's another use for without buying and selling process.
Great. You'll notice we just put up the polls that we have as we come to a close here. We've still got a couple questions, so don't log off quite yet, but please go ahead and answer those polls for us. All right, we've got a couple questions about informal trade, which you touched a little bit upon already, but let's go ahead and address these as well. Marietta Stevens asked, said, informal trade is a major challenge. What are some of the strategies put in place to have more of the informal trade information captured? And Emily Miller also contributed, who are the cross-border traders that you are addressing? Does it include women in more informal cross-border trade? And if included, how is the capacity being addressed?
Thank you. I'll take those questions and refer us back to the intro that I've given about EAGC. And one of the things I say was that part of our services is that we do provide market information through our regional agricultural trade intelligence network, RATIN. And in RATIN, we monitor border points and we monitor markets. In fact, at the moment, we are monitoring 42 markets in the region and 15 border points. And we do monitor both formal and informal cross-border trade. And we do get data on the informal cross-border trade taking place in the region that we're able to record and give. If you do visit www.ratin.net, you should be able to get quite a lot of that. In addition to that, especially with regard to capacity building of the informal traders, we also have a number of training programs through our institute, the Eastern Africa Grain Institute, and in this we are able to handle quite a number of topics like for service handling. We expose the traders to the grades and standards. We also, you know, and the whole handling process, and also we are able to connect them to the markets across the borders, those that are doing the informal trade. And we try as much as possible to also make them, you know, also get a little bit more sophisticated to formalize their trade. And luckily, we've been having initiatives in the region with the regional economic communities coming up with simplified regimes and simplified processes that can move the informal trade to formal, but with a fewer set of documentation and without compromising on quality and on the safety of the food. So basically, I would like to just say that very, very quickly, and to say that also women, when it comes to cross-border trade, definitely they do play a major role, and we do have a particular support towards them, even especially those that also go to a level of being able to operate warehouses, like a diva manage the warehouse kind of process. So in general, I'd like to respond that way. But remember, our topic today was looking at trade, particularly the B2B, which are more formal arrangements and formal setups. Thank you.
Just to add to Gerald's answer, the hub also works, again, works with informal cross-border traders. Last year, in partnership with AgMark, a regional organization, we helped with the establishment of the East Africa Community Small Cross-Border Traders Association. We worked with 42 different cross-border traders association. In fact, about 20,000 metric tons of the B2Bs reported in our 1.2 million metric tons came from these B2Bs that we supported through our partnership with AgMark. That process involved training the cross-border traders association on structured trade, on access to finance, on standards, and the like, on the logistics issues, but also on regional grain trade. This is very, very important to us. This year, we'll be specifically focusing on the eastern part of the EAC region. We'll be working specifically with women cross-border traders and trader associations to build our capacity, again, on formal trade, grain standards, documentary requirements, structured trade, logistics management, and the like, with another regional partner in the region. We've also worked specifically with women cross-border traders, training them on how to access the regional finance for trade, like trade finance or SME financing. And we've also worked with women and small cross-border traders on making new technologies available to them. So there's a lot of work that we do with cross-border trade because it's important. In the EAC region, about 60% of the overall grain trade is informal, so you can't really ignore it. We work very hard to make sure that 60% is reduced to a smaller amount and we'll have greater amount of formal transparent trade in the region. Thank you. I think with this, we're running out of time, the allocated time. I'll give you back the mic, Kristen.
Okay, great. Scott, did you have any closing remarks on your end?
No, I'm not prepared, but I mean, I do think this is a very impressive model going forward. I mean, there are several issues that still need to be addressed throughout the region in terms of movement of staple foods and food security at large, I think this is a great example of how we can work closely with the private sector and help unlock the potential and, you know, the food production that is already there in the region. So, but thank you, everyone.
Great. Thank you so much to our speakers, and thank you to our audience for joining us today and bearing with some of our technical difficulties. It's always a challenge when you're pulling people across far-flung geographies. I think we'll see if we can give Shishilo a chance to maybe put some of his responses into a blog post that can accompany the event resources since we lost his audio. And keep your eyes open for when we send out our post-event resources email. It will have links to everything you need to share this with your colleagues or go back to revisit anything you'd like to review. And next month, mark your calendars, AgriLinks and MicroLinks will be joined by the Office of U.S. Foreign Disaster Assistance, featuring research from Purdue on seed storage, marketing, and finance. And that will be February 22nd, so we hope to see you back then. And that will also include an in-person component for those of you that are based locally in Washington, D.C., so you can join us live or remotely. We hope to see you then. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you.